This is Current State. I'm Emmanuel Berry in for Mark Bayshore. Today, later in the show, we're going to introduce our new series, Voices of Experience, with the Eternal General. That's Frank Kelly. Also, we have an essay on Banned Book Week. But first, for 45 years, Lansing's Christo Rey Community Center has offered health, legal, and other services with an emphasis on Lansing's Hispanic community. Last week, Christo Rey welcomed a new executive director whose job will be to do more with less. Funding in the next fiscal year, which begins in just a few days, will drop by more than $500,000. Christo Rey's new director is a business owner and the son of a former migrant worker from Mexico. Joe Garcia is also the ex-director of MBA Career Services at Michigan State University and has experience in the nonprofit world. He says he wants to use his business experience to build relationships and expand the reach of Christo Rey Services. Joe Garcia, congratulations first, and welcome to Current State.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate the invitation.
So first, tell me a little bit about what Christo Rey's mission is.
Christo Rey, a Catholic-based organization, you know, we're here for the purpose of meeting the needs of the poor, the vulnerable, and the marginalized. You know, we provide services to help to give a hand up. Some of the things we do, for instance, is that we have a health clinic that operates 6 days a week to meet the needs of the community there. You know, certainly healthy folks are able to do more and get themselves out there in the workforce and accomplish what they want to do for themselves and for their families. We have a wonderful prescription assistance program, great counseling services in the areas of substance abuse, anger management, domestic violence, some counseling programs in the area of parenting, women's services. We have a senior program, nutrition outreach. We have a wonderful food pantry. We have some unique programs, like one, for instance, that's called Tech en la Casa. And Tech en la Casa is all about helping folks get more comfortable, acclimated with computers and working online, you know, filling out forms online and those kind of things. You know, a lot of efficiencies happen with being able to use those type of that type of technology. You know, Hispanic Women Network, and of course, some migrant outreach.
Now, of those programs that you just mentioned, which ones are the ones that are most in demand?
Well, the health clinic gets much use. We see a large amount of folks with various needs, and a service that we're certainly very proud of, and again gets highly utilized on a daily basis. The counseling programs we have a great influx of people coming in and getting those services. But I would say that in those two general areas, that would be the higher demand items. But certainly, you know, with regards to a food pantry, when there is need for food, we're there. As well as, you know, the seniors, you know, providing, programs, outlets, opportunities to get out there and get engaged and meet others. So, they're high value. All these programs with regards to, they're meeting a need. And certainly that's what we're about. We're about meeting the needs for some folks whose needs oftentimes get unmet.
It seems like your programs really run the gamut in the sense of who they serve age-wise. You're talking about programs for children. You're talking about programs for seniors. But I guess who is the typical recipient of the services that you offer?
And again, actually, something I forgot to mention would be youth programs, after school programs as well. But you know, typical is our folks who have need in North Lansing primarily, and it's not yes, we serve a Hispanic population, and Christo Rey certainly Spanish title of the organization, but. We meet and we work with all the members of the community there, and as far as all that goes, is we're here to help first and foremost. So, It really is. It can be the gamut. It can be the young 10-year-old who needs to have some positive interaction after school, and it can be the 85-year-old senior citizen who really doesn't just want to sit home all day long.
Your dad was a migrant farm worker in Michigan and Ohio. Tell me a little bit about him and I guess how he's impacted you.
My dad was a migrant worker and, many of his brothers as well. I'll do my very best to keep it together as far as all this goes because it's pretty near and dear. You know, I feel a lot of gratitude with regards to the efforts that he, as well as my mother, made along the way. But the work of a migrant worker, it's hard, and they do it because it creates opportunity. You know, a young man from Mexico. I mean, honestly, he has been at the age of, 14, 15 years old, he was up here working various farms in Michigan and Ohio, tomatoes, onions, and other crop to save money, to send back home and to help the family. You know, and that is kind of the life and the purpose of a lot of the migrant workers here. I mean, they're here to work. And with his efforts, no exception there. Now as a young man, maybe 20 years ago as a young man, you recognize what he has done and what other children of migrant, parents do, the sacrifices they made. You know, it is, what's the proper term? It's all about, wanting to help the family. And at any rate, a tough life, but in the end, something that helped build who he is. And certainly he has taught his family the importance of working hard. And, fortunately, again, his efforts were recognized. And, I'm sitting across this little table here with you, speaking to you about running a worthy organization, and certainly my background. My father allowed me to get the education, to get the experience, to get the necessary skills to help move a program like this forward.
Tell me a little bit about some of the things that you want to do in your position. Some new things, some improvements, some changes.
Well, what I want to do is I want to continue at Cristo Rey to do the good that we already have, certainly at a larger scale, because there are many needs out there, and we're in tough economic times. The state and many of other states across this nation are in tough economic times, so their ability to help support some of these programs aren't there like they had been in the past. So certainly what I'd like to be able to do is reach out to private foundations, other groups to help us and maintain what we're already doing. I'd love to be able to expand the type of services that we have in the clinic. I would love to be able to expand the pantry and the education as it relates to nutrition. Our seniors in our community, they've worked hard. It would be great to be able to recognize their efforts by having very comprehensive, very meaningful type of programs for them. Help in the area of transportation too. Have them bring them to the center or to other events. Would love to be able to do more for that. I mean, we need to demonstrate gratitude to those folks that have put in their time, done their hard work.
You mentioned briefly cuts to funding there. You guys are going to be down over $500,000 from last year's budget with this year. Are these cuts just coming from the federal government? You're not getting as much aid from the federal government? Or where are these cuts coming from?
Well, I mean, a significant cut is presenting itself through Michigan Works and through some employment programs that we had there. And basically, as I mentioned, tough economic times, In the past, for instance, these employment-related programs, we in the Lansing area, they would, let's say, three agencies would provide these services. And based on cuts, they had to move that down to one. Unfortunately, we weren't the one that was going to move forward along those lines. But here's the good news about that, you know, and I'm always looking for the good. The good is that we still have services available here in the Lansing area for the folks and as it relates to this employment training type efforts. So that is good. You know, it's now one facility or one location where folks are going in North Lansing for that, but that's okay. The services exist. You know, many of my employees who worked in that particular area, too, are being picked up by that particular vendor. And there's still a couple that are looking for work. But you know what? They know a little bit about finding a job. They're going to be okay.
Now, you have business experience and nonprofit experience. But I want you to speak a little bit about how you think working in the past in a business field is going to aid you in working at Christa Rae in your new position.
Well, I have a sales background, and part of my sales background, when we're looking for opportunity, I always say, you know, you got to turn stones, you got to flip stones, you got to look. If you don't ask, the answer is always no. So I think that my for-profit experience as in sales, what we'll call a person who carries a bag, who works independently out in pursuing sales, I think some of that resilience, some of that effort will certainly help in that, not letting shortfalls or temporary setbacks, you know, stop me from a particular effort. I was in sales management for a lot of years and building teams. You know, I know how to bring the best out of individuals and help them stay focused, and I believe that that will be a great value. You know, my experience with Michigan State University and running the MBA Career Services Office, you know, that was about there was a lot of a network, but different type of education going on here. It an opportunity to work with Fortune 500 employers and communicating with them and trying to understand the needs of those particular businesses, and now relaying it back to to the professors of these MBA programs and saying, hey, look, we're finding that these companies are finding that they have a need in this particular area A, area B, area C, and they're looking for these MBAs to be able to have and have this type of experience, be able to work in a particular environment. Make adjustments to what is taught so that they can be better prepared when they're out there. And on the other hand, there we're with the employers in general, educating them about the students and what they're learning and their eagerness to be out there and making a difference. So good relationship things as far as that goes. Small business is wonderful, high reward, because you get to meet folks every day, like on a just like we are, right across the table mm-hmm. from each other. From a business perspective, what it teaches you is that, you know, it teaches you how to be thrifty. It teaches you how to maximize. It keeps you very aware of your day-to-day, your finances. So certainly what that will help in this particular role is to make sure that we're as fiscally responsible as we can be. You know, I've often said, you know, I want to be spiritually generous and fiscally responsible. And I think we owe that in how we operate. And that's what I intend to do.
I'm curious, are you following the Congress's efforts at passing a new immigration bill?
I have some familiarity. I'll tell you my passion and how I follow different legislation, and that is that, I'm concerned with the issues that the people, that the migrant folks, address, and oftentimes, you know, their contributions aren't really seen for what they are. Again, the migrant population are here; they're here to work. You know, in Michigan, I think during peak season, there's around 46,000 migrants that work mm-hmm. here, and you know what? Their efforts impact a $91 billion. Impact here in the state of Michigan in the area of agriculture and food. You know, they're contributors. They're helping our state along. And sometimes I think some of these focus on their value is not seen.
On a personal level, what are you looking forward to most about this new position?
I want to let the community know again what Crystal Ray has silently been doing for over 45 years. This is of great value. We make a difference, just like a lot of organizations. And I know that that's very plain and that can be very broad. But, you know, sometimes it's not a very complicated thing that needs to be done to make a great impact in a family, in a family's life. You know, I tell the story of my dad once here with and mom, and that you know, working at St. Cornelius and Leslie at church, he was a groundskeeper. You know, he was a janitor. He was a bus driver. He worked very, very hard, and his efforts were recognized. You know, we had a priest there who knew of jobs coming up in the railroad, helped him, you know, with application processes and things, and he landed that job. Well, I'll tell you, that was probably something very easy for that pastor to do. That was life-changing for us. So, and that's what we're doing. We're focusing on helping folks in ways that they need right now. The impact, we might not see that for 5, 10, 15, 20 years, but it's there. You know, we got to do the good work, and that's what ends up happening. And I want to make aware to the community at large the wonderful things that happen here.
Joe Garcia is the new executive director at Crystal Ray Community Center. Joe, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
And now time for another public poetry announcement read by Kern State contributor Stephanie Glazier.
With Mercy for the Greedy by Anne Sexton. Concerning your letter in which you ask me to call a priest, and in which you ask me to wear the cross that you enclose, your own cross, your dog-bitten cross, no larger than a thumb, small and wooden, no thorns this rose. I pray to its shadow, that gray place where it lies on your letter, deep, deep. I detest my sins, and I try to believe in the cross. I touch its tender hips, its dark-jawed face, its solid neck, its brown sleep. True, there is a beautiful Jesus. He is frozen to his bones like a chunk of beef. How desperately he wanted to pull his arms in. How desperately I touch his vertical and horizontal axes. But I can't. Need is not quite belief. All morning long I have worn your cross, hung with package string around my throat. It tapped me lightly as a child's heart might, tapping secondhand softly, waiting to be born. Ruth, I cherish the letter you wrote. My friend, I was born doing reference work in sin and born confessing it. This is what poems are. With mercy for the greedy, they are the tongue's wrangle, the world's pottage, the rat's star. With Mercy for the Greedy by Anne Sexton. For Current State, I'm Stephanie Glazier.
The first MSU Symphony Orchestra concert of the season is tomorrow night at Wharton Center. Featured works include Ludoslavsky's Concerto for Orchestra and a clarinet concerto by John Corigliano. Kern State's Melissa Benmark spoke with conductor Kevin No and the clarinet soloist about putting together the concert.
My name is Guy Yehuda. I'm the clarinet professor at MSU. And a few months back, when Maestro No sent me this email welcoming me to MSU, and also there was invitation for Corigliano to do a Corigliano concerto, which
that's our version of a welcome.
Yes, it's a nice welcome. Which in the clarinet world, the Corigliano is considered one of the toughest concerto ever written for clarinet. It's an amazing piece. One of his, I think, really magnum opus of John Corigliano. Because of the magnitude of the piece and the length and the difficulty, it poses challenges on every aspect of this medium of a concerto. The clarinet part is extremely, extremely difficult and challenging, but at the same time, it's extremely rewarding. It's one of those pieces that you work hard, but it's really rewarding at the end. And I think both for performers and for audiences alike. So, of course, I couldn't refuse to take a challenge like that, more so since it's really rare to have a performance of a piece like that because of the difficulties it poses on the soloist and what as well on the orchestra. It requires a massive orchestra, and you can really count on one hand performances probably not in even every year around the world. So obviously, I had to jump on this opportunity to perform this this piece.
So sort of like, glad you're in town, let's climb Mount Everest.
That's it. Yeah.
Something like that. It's let's do this. And it's a remarkable piece. And John Corigliano wrote it in the 70s. In 76, he started when he was commissioned by the New York Philharmonic. And that's what's unique about this piece, that he knew every instrumentalist in that orchestra when he wrote it to Stanley Drucker and Leonard Bernstein, the dedicatee. But the personal part of this piece, which I think is really phenomenal, he wrote it in memory of his father that died the previous year in 1975, I believe. And he was the concertmeister of the New York Phil. So the middle of this concerto, this beautiful elegy for his dad. On so many levels, it's such a complex piece, but also very emotional, very simple in a way of just like this memories of a father as seen by his son. Through the complexity, there's a lot of simplicity, a lot of things that people can connect with. And it's very beautiful because there is a nice dialogue between the clarinet part and the first violin of the orchestra, as though it's his father playing still there. So, but the other aspects of this concerto is the way that he constructed this concerto, and I said before, it posed a huge challenge because he was attempting to use the entire orchestra, the entire New York Phil, in a concerto, which is very unheard of, because usually with concerti, especially with winds, you have to reduce the orchestra a bit, and also the span of the piece, usually 15 minutes. Here he used a Philharmonic orchestra, and for half an hour. So he kind of challenged himself to see how he can work with, you know, in order not to cover the soloist because of the magnitude of the sound. So he devised this way of reducing the players on the stage, but then relocating them in the hall for the last movement, so that you have this kind of antiphonal call back and forth between the soloist, the orchestra, the different parts in the orchestra, and the players in the audience, which creates this really amazing effect and very powerful as well. It's a very exciting experience. And I think it's an exciting experience not only for me playing it and for the orchestra and for Kevin conducting it, it's for the audience, I think, to be like in it, especially for the last movement.
We're going to switch chairs here and talk to conductor Kevin Noe. And just, you know, since we're on the Corigliano, tell me about how you've been preparing for it. And more specifically, how do you two have to brief each other in terms of, you know, what's happening with the orchestra?
Well, I think Guy and I have established ourselves as blood brothers over this process. I mean, we somewhere in the room when you're dealing with a beast, a wonderful beast, but a beast like this, you have to have a place of trust. So he and I have a plan. You know, we've met several times and we keep reviewing our plan. And if we count on each other, that gives us a kind of rock from which to proceed, you know. I think a great deal of that piece, the technical challenge is the first step is simply navigating it. Figuring out how we're going to get from one spot to the next is step one. And because of the particular way he's laid that out, that takes a lot longer than most pieces. However, the real challenge is the second step, saving enough time to get back to the place where now that we've got that solved, we're making music, we're making refinements, we're really listening to each other, we're working on sound color, we're working on other things, and we're not simply working on trying to avoid falling off the cliff because of the difficulty of the way the thing is laid down, you know. I think the piece is worth it. It's definitely challenging. And the way he's written it down is, you know, you look at it at first and you think, surely there's a better way to do this. And then the longer you think about it, you think, well, I don't think so. I don't think there's any other way that he could write it down. And it's worth it for the effects, but it definitely asks one to step up to the plate. It's a big commitment, this piece.
The Lutoslawski, the other major work on the program, besides the Debussy Afternoon of a Faun, which of course we all know is gorgeous, and I know you're a big Debussy fan, but people may be not as familiar with Lutoslawski as other composers. If you were making your pitch to somebody of why they would want to listen to this piece, this concerto for orchestra, what would it be?
I would say the same thing that I would say about any of the great masters of the last, say, 60, 70, even 100 years. And that is that anything worth hearing is worth hearing multiple times. Mozart opera does not give up all of its riches the first time that you see it. Afternoon of a Faun that you mentioned, a great masterwork, still surprises me. I mean, I feel like I could conduct the entire thing on no notice now from memory. I know it really well. I could write down almost all of it for you. And yet, every day I see something new. And this is music that's now 120, 116 years old or something like this. The Lutoslawski is no different. This thing is an undeniable masterpiece. The people who have come into contact with it while we are rehearsing it think, oh my God, what is that? I want some of that. Where can I get a recording of this? It's worth hearing multiple times if it makes even a modestly powerful impression on you. Grab yourself a recording, and I promise you it will pay you back in spades. He is one of the great geniuses of that century, and that symphony has an unchecked titanic energy that I think anyone can respond to. But it is challenging. It's not challenging in that incoherent, pejorative way that people often talk about new music. It doesn't have a new music quality to it, but there is an edge about it that is, I think, a reflective of his times that, again, asks us to step up in a kind of unique way. But the energy is unescapable. Get yourself a recording, or you could even get yourself a recording of us playing it if you particularly like the way we do it.
MSU Director of Orchestras Kevin Ngo, MSU Professor of Clarinet Guy Yehuda, and Kern State's Melissa Benmark. The concert is tomorrow night at 8 at Wharton Center. We all know Michiganians, we feel, are extraordinary for their memorable life experiences or their sacrifices, maybe for their successes, their service, or for their insights. Getting better acquainted with extraordinary people is the focus of Kern State's new ongoing series, Voices of Experience. Arguably, no one shares Frank J. Kelly's perspective on Michigan, the Attorney General, or Attorney General, if you will. From 1961 to 1988, Kelly became the state's youngest and oldest AG during his tenure. For decades, Frank Kelly has been considered a groundbreaking crusader in consumer and environmental protection. Mr. Kelly started his discussion with Kern State's Mark Bayshore by going back to the very beginning.
I was born just before New Year's on December 31st. My mother was told by her obstetrician that I was not going to be along for a couple more weeks. So she bought a beautiful party dress and she was going to go out with my dad on New Year's Eve. And then December 31st in the afternoon, she went to the show with my aunt, I think it was a Marion Davies movie or something, and all of a sudden she started getting labor pains, and that was the end of it. They took her from the Michigan Theater in Detroit to the hospital, and I was born about 10:30 that night. I killed her New Year's Eve, but she didn't mind too much.
So Detroit, a Detroit upbringing.
Yeah, Detroit. I was born in Detroit December 31st, 1924, and that's when Detroit was, you know, a great city, third largest city in America, the wealthiest per capita income city in the world, mm-hmm. And more home ownership than in New York or Chicago. percentage of people owning their own homes and so on. It was just a prosperous, and it was a beautiful town. And as a youngster growing up there, I felt fortunate, you know, to be a Detroiter.
What were your younger years like in general? Pretty conventional for that time? Or?
Well, what happened was my dad was prosperous in the 20s in real estate and different things. I was born in 25, and that was during the Roaring 20s. So my dad did fairly well. And what happened in 1930 came the Big Depression. And my dad lost a lot of interest in real estate and lost money. So our standard of living dropped about 50% during the Depression. And I do remember that. But we were never rich. We were never poor. We were always somewhere in between. So yeah. I had a good middle-class upbringing in Detroit. And I went to the parochial schools in Detroit, St. Teresa's. And then I graduated from a school called Visitation, which is in the heart of Detroit at 12th and Webb. But I was lucky because they gave intelligence tests in the 7th grade, and based on that, they allowed me to skip a couple grades, which sounded like a good idea at the time. But it was a terrible idea because the kids I left behind, they had nothing to do with me. You know, the kids you left behind, they had nothing to do with your freak. And then it made us worse. Instead of putting us in with the 9th graders, they put us in a glass room separate from the 9th graders, so we couldn't be accepted by the new group. We were the glass freaks. And I just didn't like it at all. So as a result of that, I went to UAD High, which was a very strict all-boys school. I went there for a year, and I didn't fit in there properly either. And so I was pretty well lost. But the nuns who had skipped me at St. Teresa's School moved to another high school, and they called my mother and said, "We realized that we made a mistake with Frank and a few people. Have him come over to our new high school where we're at Visitation. We'll treat him like an adult, and nobody will know he's younger, you know," and so on. So I went over to Visitation High School, and I graduated from there. And I was a salutarian in a class and leading the senior play, and I was a big man on the high school campus at that. So I lucked out. In other words, what could have been a bad situation turned out to be pretty good. And that's the story of my life. Whenever I had a bad situation, something happened to make things better, and I'm very appreciative.
You held a lot of interesting jobs as a younger guy. Tell our listeners a little bit about about that.
Well, my dad was an orphan, and so in his teens, and he had to work hard. He and his brothers had to work hard. Orphan in a sense of both their mother and father were dead, and they had to work at anything that came along. And I don't know, it must have been in my genes because I didn't have to work. My family was pretty well off, but I said to my dad, "Can I lie about my age and get in a merchant marine?" And my dad said, "Well, I'll let you lie about your age to work, but not to drink." So I got the seaman's papers from the merchant marine, federal merchant marine, and I was sailing on the car ferries up at the Straits of Mackinac where the bridge is now.
Mm-hmm.
They used to have Michigan State car ferries, and I worked on those car ferries for 3 summers from the time I was 14 till I was 16. I was supposed to be 18. But nobody knew the difference, and I did that, and that was an interesting job. I had all kinds of jobs on those boats, you know, and I made friends, life-lasting friends that I made up there. After high school, I went to college. I imagine you go to college when you're 15 and a half. I was at college, and I didn't know how to study. I didn't know how to do anything, and by Christmas of the first year of college, I was out on the street, you know, figuring, well, this has been a failure. And then I wound up with a job in a defense plant working there. And I sat next to a fellow who had been Big Ten tennis champ at the University of Michigan. He said, "I don't like this factory job." He said, "I think I've got a chance to go out to Arizona and work at a dude ranch as a tennis pro. Why don't you come out there with me and you can go to Arizona State College while you're out there?" And I said, "Okay." So my parents gave me the permission, and I went out to Arizona State College. And that's when my roommate became Steve Allen, who later became the TV star of the Tonight Show and so on. He was a struggling student just like I was out there. And he was from Chicago. And we had something in common, the fact that we were Midwesterners. And his mother had been a famous piano player in vaudeville. Her name was Belle Allen. And she played for all the big acts in vaudeville. And Steve was a behind-the-stage boy raised in a stage trunk, you might say. And he came to Arizona because of an asthmatic condition. That's why he was going to school there. And I was just going to school out there because of of something to do for my friend.
What was it like to watch Steve Allen's career explode after you were college roommates with him?
I was in law school when he was exploding. He went to he got a job at WKPHO in Phoenix, Arizona, at a little station we were at, and then he got a job in L.A. after that. He went in the Army for a couple of months, but they wouldn't keep him because of his asthma. So that way he was out of that in a couple of months. So he had a job in L.A., and Groucho Marx heard him one night on the radio and said, "That kid sounds smart to me. Said, I want to interview him." So he had an interview with Groucho Marx, and Groucho Marx had him signed to CBS. He got a contract with CBS, and they signed him up for a couple of years. He didn't do much. Then CBS let him go in New York, and NBC signed him up. And because he was an unusual guy, they put him on a Tonight Show, and he was a big hit and a big star. And, of course, I'm struggling away at law school then, but I got vicarious pleasure out of the fact that my buddy Steve Allen was a big star. He used to come to Detroit and put me up on a stage with him when he'd do his act. And I'd get up on the act and on a stage with him at the Rooster Tail in Detroit, different venues, and we got along very well. But then as he got older, he got to become very conservative, and he got so conservative that he didn't want to associate with his old, more progressive friends, and so I lost track of him.
As a young guy, why did you want to become an attorney?
My father was interested in public service with two reasons. One reason was my father had a friend who was a boxing manager. He owned in boxing in 1920s and 30s. If you had a boxer, they called him the owner. It was almost like slavery. In other words, Joe Louis had two owners. They called them owners.
Oh.
And they were just agents and managers. They owned the contracts, in other words, to the boxer,
okay.
Which means, in effect, legally, they did own them. And my dad had a friend who was manager of a prize fighter, and he was lightweight champ of the world, and they used to fight like Dempsey would fight for $100,000 gates in Madison Square Garden.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that meant that the agent got $10,000. For that fight, and I thought, oh, what a nice way to make a living. If you had a good education, you were a lawyer, and had something to offer, you could be a theatrical agent. So I wanted to go to law school to be a theatrical agent, but my dad said, oh, no, I want you to be a public service, which is kind of an Irish-American credo. Public service is the highest calling, and commerce is not. And by the time I did become a lawyer, I gave in to my father's wishes, and I said, okay, I won't become a theatrical agent. I'll become a public service lawyer. And
you adapted to public service pretty well.
Yeah, well, I was very lucky and I'm very grateful that I had a good career.
In your time as Attorney General, you focused a lot on consumer protection. How would you rate us now as a state and as a country in terms of how well we protect consumers?
You got to remember that I became Attorney General in December of 1961, just a couple of days before the new year, and nobody had ever heard of consumer protection. There was no term. There was not a term consumer protection in the American parlance. It was not heard of. And I had an attorney by the name of Maxine Virtue. She was a graduate of Yale and a brilliant woman. And she said, I should use the Office of Attorney General to help the buying public more. And she said, you should do that. I said, well, you think of ways to do it, and we'll do it. And she did, and we started starting cases after, you know, suing for consumers, and the courts allowed us to do it. And then we'd find somebody, you know, in a business where they were cheating the customers. They'd have to give the refund back. We started little by little. And it got to be so good that I set up a consumer protection division with a couple lawyers in it. And that was the first consumer protection division in the United States. And within a few years, everybody's in consumer protection. Every corporation's got a consumer protection division. They all want to protect the consumer, but when I started, nobody wanted to protect anybody. We did the same thing in environmental law. There was no such thing as environmental law as a section of the bar or anything. I had a fellow by the name of Stu Freeman who wanted to start environmental suits, and he had a theory of how we could sue polluters and get the court to make them repair the situation.
Mm-hmm.
We had a lot of great cases going, and I was the only attorney in Michigan that actually had court cases in pollution, the only one. There was no such thing as an environmental lawyer. And we got going on that, and we were so successful, we set up an environmental division. And then in the 60s and 70s, Michigan recovered more money and more work ordered by the courts in the area of conservation and pollution in any state in the union. And so in those two fields, consumer protection and conservation, I did quite well. And then I did a lot of lawsuits against the public utilities that were, if I thought they were charging too much in their rate increases, I would sue them. Or if I thought they were mismanaging the construction of their plants, I would sue them. And I had very successful cases on those in courts where I actually got tens of millions of dollars of refunds for people, which was unprecedented up till that time. And so I had a reputation of consumer protection, environment, and public intervention cases.
Mm-hmm.
And based on that, that's why I was allowed later. I got involved in a tobacco case where in the late 80s, we successfully sued American Tobacco. Nobody'd ever succeeded. And that was the largest single successful tort case against a wrongdoer, in this case the tobacco companies, ever brought in America.
Mm-hmm.
And that resulted in billions of dollars. The settlement in Michigan alone over 25 years, over $15 billion they paid in the state of Michigan.
Which of those are you proudest of just as big topics, the environment, consumer protection, the tobacco lawsuit? Is there one that you're really most proud of?
All of these things were joint efforts. What happened, I said I had Maxine Virtue, the lawyer in consumer protection. I loved her. She was a great, brilliant woman. I graduated from Yale Law School, all honors. Stu Freeman was a brilliant guy in the area of consumer protection, of environment. And then Hugh Anderson, a brilliant graduate of the University of Michigan, became the number one expert in America on utilities. And so each time we won in those areas, it was because I was a partner with my great favorite lawyers. And so it was kind of like a team winning rather than just an individual winning. And believe it or not, there was nobody pushing us. It was not like today where newspapers would say, that's a good thing. As a matter of fact, when I started consumer protection, there were actually hearings in the legislature saying, we ought to cut out Frank Kelly's money and not give him any money in consumer protection because he's interfering with a free enterprise system, and that's communistic.
Oh, my.
And they were against me. And the same thing with the environment. What are you doing suing these corporations? They provide jobs. And you have no right to be doing that. That's not your job. And I was bucking that trend, too. And then, of course, the utilities was the same thing. What are you doing in the utilities? They're regulated by the public service committee. You have no business involved in there, despite the fact that I've got tens of millions of dollars in refunds. It was years before I ever got any recognition in that area. But it was mainly pleasing in the memory of my father, because if there ever was public service, that was public service.
I guess. We're talking with former Michigan Attorney General Frank J. Kelly here on Current State. The item pricing law, which is another one of your accomplishments, was in effect for 33 years. And in 2011, it was repealed. What did it feel like to watch that rise and then fall?
Well, what happened was I was never against the idea of eventually eliminating item pricing if the retailers would be conscientious in enforcing the pricing, you know? What happened was that with the advance of the early computers, They would put out an advertisement of, like you get them today in the newspapers, a fold of sale at Kohl's, a sale at Target, a sale at, and you look at all these sale items. They managed to get those out 2 weeks in advance, but they forgot to change the computer on the cash registers at the store. So the person would come in, and instead of getting the product for $2.50, they didn't notice it. But they were actually paying $3. Okay. They were still charging them the same price. And I said, that's really a misrepresentation. And so we advocated having everything priced to clear up that situation. And I was able to get the legislature to pass it. I think California and Michigan passed it. Not too many states passed it. But that was where they had to itemize everything in the store. Oh, they hated me for that. They had to hire help. Every canned goods, everything in the store had to be, and the public loved it because you knew what you were paying for it. And that did not endear me with the retailers, to say the least. But it worked very effectively, and it kept them honest. But I said right from the beginning, if they would, you know, turn on the computers and get this price right, they can do it. And so we took surveys, and each year they got a little bit better, and to the point where when they repealed it, I was no longer Attorney General. I didn't mind it because 49 states said, we're not doing it anymore. They got it down to where the mistakes were less than 0.1%, you know, of an overcharge. Mm-hmm. Well, I said, as long as you conscientiously are enforcing it, there's no need for the law anymore. But for several years, there was a need, and we supplied an outlet, and the public liked it. And not only that, but if you caught them overcharging, like a 50 cents or a dollar, you could show your receipt. They had to pay you $5 right off the bat for the first offense, and then $10. And so that was the Kelly refund. They didn't like me very much at all. I don't think I could get a job at retailing.
When your job is fighting things like pollution or people being hurt by products, and you do that job for over 37 years, as you did, you could get a pretty dim view of humanity. What have you done over the years to keep perspective and not get dragged down by people breaking laws and doing the wrong thing?
You know, I've had a lot of time to think about that situation. You know, all through college, you think about the economic conditions of America. Every college kid did in those days. You have to have bull sessions in the dormitory about the economic system. They don't do much anymore, but they used to. And as I approach my 90s, and after sober reflection, I have to say that I believe that the free market capitalist system can work productively for the welfare of the majority of citizens if it's properly regulated in the public interest. In other words, I don't mind the idea of a free market corporation being dominant in society, which they are now, as long as they take care of their workers. My example that I turn to all the time is the Scandinavian countries. Go to any country in Scandinavia, and they have the free market capitalist system. And they do very well, and they're very, very profitable operations. Corporations are just as free there as they are here. The only difference is the workers in those countries are taken care of. There's no such thing as worrying about Obamacare in a country like that. For example, in all the Scandinavian countries, you have complete health care from the time you're born until you die. That's complete, and it only costs them a little bit to do that. No, here they, for some reason or other, the workers are bad, the teachers are bad, and that's my only beef. In other words, I'm not a revolutionary. I don't want to change the system or anything like that. I just want to make sure that we practice free market capitalism in the best sense of the word, like they do in other countries.
What about a beneficial ruling, though? Which one do you look back on and say, that was the right thing to do?
Well, I won the apportionment case. It was Baker versus Carr. That's where the Supreme Court held that every legislative body that I brought to their attention in the United States was malapportioned. We actually had state Senate districts in Michigan where one senator would represent maybe 65,000 people and 2 million trees, okay? He'd be a state senator. Another person would represent 265,000 people, and all he got was one Senate seat. And that wasn't right. It should have been apportioned on the basis of population, which is what our founding fathers wanted it to be. And you'd think that that would be obvious. Well, we had to fight it all the way to the United States Supreme Court. And finally, they did say that that was malapportionment, and every legislative body in the United States had to be reapportioned on the basis of population. That temporarily was probably my biggest single victory.
Michigan legendary Attorney General Frank J. Kelly with Kern State's Mark Bayshore in the first installment of Kern State's new occasional series, Voices of Experience. Listen for part two of this conversation with the Attorney General next week. If you'd like to nominate an extraordinary Michiganian for consideration, email us at currentstate@wkar.org. You're listening to Kern State here on WKAR. I'm Emmanuel Berry in for Mark Bayshore. 50 Shades of Grey, Beloved, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, the Harry Potter series. What do all of these books have in common? At one time or another, in one place or another, they've all been banned. It's Banned Book Week this week, and current state contributor Scott Southard shares his thoughts on the efforts to save us from corrupting our souls.
The playwright Anton Chekhov has this great rule for writing a play. To summarize it, if a gun appears in the first act, it has to go off by the last act. What Chekhov is tapping into is that a gun is threatening, a gun can kill. An audience remembers it is there, and each and every playgoer expects that sooner or later, for better or worse, it will be fired. I remember once I saw a production of Hamlet by the Royal Shakespeare Company, and they showed Hamlet with the gun in the first act. He carried it in his coat wherever he went on that stage, his concealed weapon, and we always knew it was there, expecting it sooner or later to cause destruction. Because a gun will always be fired, fictional or real, and there are always consequences for one being around. The funny thing is, there are pockets in our country where people feel more at ease with guns than books. Yes, it's Banned Book Week, where once again we stop to think about our First Amendment rights and think about the books that are kicked out of our libraries and schools. In 2012, the most banned book in our country was a series of children's books called Captain Underpants by Dev Pilkey. Let's be honest, Captain Underpants is not Huckleberry Finn. They are honestly not at the top of the reading list for my kids, but I wouldn't tell someone else's child they can't enjoy them. Yet that is what someone attempts to do each time these books are taken off shelves. The funny thing about Banned Book Week is that these attempts at removing a book always seems to say something more about the people trying to ban the book than the actual book itself. Consider, for example, the many attempts to ban the Harry Potter books. Do you know the main reasons the books by J.K. Rowling get banned? It is because someone, somewhere, is worried that it will drive children to magic. No, I don't mean heading off to Vegas to put on a jumpsuit and make white tigers disappear. I mean actual magic. Whoa. Then there are the books banned for language, sexuality, conflicting religious beliefs. Yet, for all their differences, each and every reason given comes down to one fact. Fear. All the books are banned or attempted to be banned because of fear. Someone is afraid that in the wrong hands, the books will be fired. And just like a gun, nothing will be the same after that trigger is pulled. Not a physical injury, but a mental and emotional one that won't go away. Their child or another's child will be permanently changed. So here's the rub, as Hamlet would say. The thing that many people seem to forget is not our First Amendment, but what it is like to be a kid. See, if you take something away, make it forbidden, you always, always make it more interesting. And because of that, the attempt to ban books always fails in the long run. And really, everyone still has a little kid in them, no matter how old. The fact is, I know I can make more of a difference with my children by explaining to them the reasons why they can't read something. Talk to them, and then listen to their argument. It is always better to sit down and discuss why something is appropriate to read and why something isn't. Just simply saying no fails to halt an inquisitive mind. A book, unlike a gun, doesn't have to go off. For Current State, this is Scott Southard.
That's it for our show today. I'm Emmanuel Berry. Thanks for listening to Current State here on WKAR.
Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and with mobile banking, insured by NCUA.